We'll start things off with CNN's John King. Is Putin winning the Cold War in Ukraine? Is Scott Brown running in New Hampshire? And is this the worst Congress ever? Then dress codes, not at your kid's school, but at Lawrence City Hall. New Mayor Daniel Rivera says no to PJs and jeans, and yes to men wearing ties. We'll ask which side you're on. Then the chief architect of RomneyCare and Obamacare, MIT's Jonathan Gruber, joins us. Is the Republican claim that the ACA is a jobs killer legit?
H&M is now selling a $99 wedding dress. Does this mean we're finally fighting back against the astronomical costs of weddings? Not just for brides, but for bridesmaids, groomsmen, and plain old guests who can't afford a three-day destination? Wedding in Tahiti. Then Nancy Kahan overhauling the SATs and how they are skewed to the rich. All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
50-something again today. Is Scott Brown running for the Senate in New Hampshire? Is Governor Christie making all the right moves by emphasizing his anti-abortion views? Is this the worst Congress ever? Joining us to go over these political stories and others is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. He's also the host of the Sunday morning show, Inside Politics. Hello there, John.
Good Tuesday afternoon. How are you guys?
Oh, great. Thank you.
Good Tuesday afternoon to you, too, especially since it's getting warmer up here, finally. So, John, before we get to all the issues that Jim just mentioned, just want to ask if there's any update on this vanished Malaysia Airlines passenger jet that they're searching for in the South China Sea and the Gulf of Thailand. Any news on that or any news on possible terrorist involvement?
You have Interpol saying they don't think there's terrorism involvement. You have some U.S. officials saying they just won't rule it out until they have more evidence. They're not saying they have any reason to rule it in. They're just being extra cautious. I've been watching this, mostly just watching all the traffic from our international people and some of our folks here in Washington trying to help with that reporting directly. And sadly, it's been, you know, every now and then you get a sighting of something and they think they might have a lead and then they move back to something else. There seemed to be the Malaysian military this morning saying they thought they might possibly have a radar track and they were going to investigate that. But best I can tell is if when I was going through things a few minutes ago, still nothing firm yet. So sad.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. You know, it was incredible to me that they were excited for a while about a 6 to 9 mile oil slick. Not that they were excited. That's the wrong word. They were thinking it might be a clue. And they said it was just an oil slick.
Came from a ship.
And you're thinking, gosh, is that unusual? 6 to 9 mile oil slicks all over the Gulf of China. But in any case, let's move on then to the Ukraine. Any headway there for President Obama? You have all these pictures on television, these Russian tanks everywhere. They're taking over military hospitals and naval bases and harassing reporters. Any headway there?
Now you've had a lot of phone calls. The president's been calling. I don't mean this in a bad way. The predictable phone calls to Western allies, to officials inside Ukraine, some of the countries surrounding there, trying to build up firm international condemnation of Vladimir Putin. And they do have that. There's pretty firm international condemnation when it comes to words. And there's some economic sanctions in place. And there's threats of canceling the G8 meeting or and the like. But look, Putin doesn't think like us, and we need to remember that when we're going through these. He doesn't think, oh, they're going to give me economic sanctions. Well, I forget it. I'm out of here. I'm sorry. It's not the way he works, and part of it is the history. He took a piece of Georgia late in the Bush administration, and he got away with it. He's taken a few other little pieces and gotten away with it. And so now, from his standpoint, I think he understands there are no good military options. Nobody's going to roll a European military or an American military or a NATO military into Ukraine. It's just simply not going to happen. And so now you're going to have a verbal standoff with some economic sanctions. It will be interesting. The prime minister of Ukraine is coming to see the president at the White House, and that prime minister has vowed not to give up one inch. And yet, when he asked for direct American help, beyond the sanctions, the president's options, the options this president or any president has, are pretty limited. And number two, if you look at the polling data, it's not a viable option anyway. But the appetite of the American people for some sort of a muscular response just doesn't exist. And that's the legacy of Iraq and Afghanistan.
You know, I know he's been talking a lot, the president has, to the chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel. Is there any truth to the rumor that when he was talking to her last night, he said, "Hey, chancellor, I was listening in on a couple of your phone calls last night." Is there any? No, okay, forget that, John.
Remember what did Bush do to her? He gave her
rubbed
a noogie
her back.
Or something?
Yeah, he was rubbing her back.
Oh, he didn't rub her head. Okay, it was her back.
No, he would rub the head of bald people, particularly servicemen. Did you ever witness that, by the way, John King?
Yeah. Yes, I witnessed some of the Bushisms, shall we call them. He was a little quirky guy. He was physical in the kind of an old school, locker room kind of way. He's the kind of guy, for the kids out there listening to me, who would give you a noogie. It's just sort of the way he was. And look, your view of George W. Bush is influenced heavily by your politics or your views of the Iraq War. As a human being, I always had a great deal of respect for him. He was very well-mannered. He was a gentleman, very well-raised. And very polite and incredibly respectful of the troops. And, it was odd when you saw that little soldier rub, to Chancellor Merkel. He was also very respectful of her as a leader, but it was just the way he was.
Yeah. Hey, where I wanted to go there, the storyline for the last couple of weeks from your part of the world is that Obama is getting totally outmaneuvered here in this semi-Cold War back and forth with Putin. Is that still the story, or are people saying, there, as you said a minute ago, there are only so many options available to this guy in dealing with him?
Well, I mean, it depends sort of how big of a photo you're looking at. How far back in time do you want to go? Is it a fair criticism that this administration miscalculated, mischaracterized, had false hopes about the relationship with Russia? I think that's without a doubt. That started with, Medvedev as president and Putin behind the scenes as prime minister. Now he's back as President Putin is. They had the reset. It was much publicized. It was the president talking about it, Secretary Clinton talking about it. They made a big deal about it. But if you go back in time, remember, I was with President Bush in Slovenia when he said he looked into Putin's soul and saw a good man and a man that he could trust. President Bush came to realize that that was a mistake. And so George W. Bush started to get tougher and more distant from the Russians late in his second term. And then Obama came in and promised this reset in a more friendly tone, largely with a goal of getting Russia to help when it comes to Iran and its nuclear program. And there's been some help from the Russians, not as much as the administration would like. But I think now they have come to the same conclusion Bush came to, that the Russians help when they feel like it or when it's in their interest. But look at Syria, look at now Ukraine, look at some other places around the world, and that this is not a productive relationship, and it's not a relationship based on trust. So are there people like John McCain saying, "I told you so"? Sure. Could Mitt Romney stand up and say, "I told you so"? Sure. Remember how mocking Obama was of Romney when Romney in 2012 said that Putin was the big geopolitical problem? In one of the debates, Obama said, Governor, the 80s called. They want their foreign policy back. He was so scornful, dismissive and mocking of him. So Governor Romney could, to some degree, say, "I told you so." But here's the problem. Now, when you hear many of the especially the 2016 contenders, saying this proves Obama's weak. No Republican said barely a peep, maybe one or two. I think McCain was one of them. He at least has consistency here. When this happened under Bush, when Putin took a piece of Georgia and enforced sanctions and essentially a blockade against Georgian exports at one point, it hurt the Georgian economy, it was virtual silence from the Republican Party. And so it's a tad hypocritical to now say, look at what's happening with President Obama. Neither president had a great option at the time, and neither president did anything. And now we'll see what President Obama does about Ukraine going down the road. But there's a tad of, lack of historical context when it comes to this Republican criticism.
But my question
to them is, if Obama is weak, then what's tough? Define tough for me. What would you do?
Well, putting tough versus weak on the back burner for a second, you mentioned two countries where Russia's involvement has been pretty critical, and one would argue that it was Putin coming to the fore that got us and got the president out of a potentially very sticky mess in Syria. Does that mean that whatever discussions are, does the coldness of the relationship now mean that all those discussions are going to come to naught and we're going to be right back where we were with Assad in a couple of months?
Well, I don't think there's any question that, at least in the short term, Assad has benefited here because the world's attention is not on Syria. And not just the people of the world who are picking up a newspaper, but the world leadership, whether it's your Putins or your Obamas or other countries involved, they had a couple of rounds of very non-productive I can't call them peace talks, diplomatic conversations between the different factions in Syria, and very little came of it except for the fact that they at least finally got them into a room and started talking. And that in and of itself is a good thing, but ultimately, what are you getting from it? There's no question that that process is at least on hold for now. I didn't have great optimism about it to begin with, and I don't think there's any evidence of any reason to be optimistic about it to begin with. But if it was at least the only dialogue you had, certainly that is one of the side effects, the side impacts of this stalemate over Ukraine. The Russians, are not going to send Minister Lavrov to sit down with Secretary Kerry and the Syrians again in the middle of this. It's just not going to happen.
We're talking with John King from CNN. Let's move back closer to home. John, you talked about this on your show Sunday morning, Inside Politics. You can see it actually at 8:30 here in Boston, about this bellwether election coming up in Florida that's supposed to be so significant for the 2014 midterms. Tell people about it.
It's today, correct?
It's today. People are voting today. There's actually been very significant absentee and early voting for the last couple of weeks, which may actually outnumber the ballots cast today. That's one of the things we'll look at when we get the results. The first thing I want to say is, don't over-listen to anybody who tells you about how important this race is, including
Good.
John King, because it's a special election being held in March. The big election is in November. If you go back to 2009 and early in 2010, there were four special elections for the House. Democrats won three of the four. And we all know what happened on Election Day in 2010. That's when you had the huge Republican rout, and Nancy Pelosi had to give up the gavel. So don't put anything you hear in the next 24 hours right down with pencil.
Okay.
Don't put it in ink and don't put it in concrete. However, I do think, now that I've said that, there are a few things to watch. This was a changing district. The Republicans have held it for 58 years, including 40 years by the Republican incumbent, Bill Young, who just recently passed away. That's why it's a special election. He held it in the end, against the demographic tide, the pro-democratic tide of the district, because of his personal popularity, because he was bringing, pork barrel spending home to the district. It's a relatively moderate district, and he was not a far-right conservative. He was on the Appropriations Committee, so, he knew how to work the district. So it would not be a shock if the Democrat wins this election, if you look at the electorate. And the Democrat running is Alex Sink. She was the Democratic nominee for governor in 2010, and she won this district, even though she lost the race for governor. She did carry this part of the state. Now, the flip side, don't be shocked if the Democrat wins. If she wins, Democrats will say this is proof the all-in on Obamacare strategy from the Republicans does not work, because that's been most of what the advertising has been about, slamming her on her support for Obamacare. The Republican candidate is a former aide to the congressman who passed away. He's a D.C. lobbyist. Even he has said he thinks some of the outside groups are overspending with too much money focused on Obamacare. But, politicians, this is a highly technical term I'm about to use, politicians are often bedwetters. And when you have a result in a special election, if they think it could affect them, they might panic. For me, I'm looking at two things. This is a very white, very old district. Old, elderly voters are the most reliable voters in a midterm election season. So we might get a few early clues, especially on the question of health care, how older people are thinking when they vote for Congress. And let's see what the turnout is, and let's see if we can get any reliable indicators of how older voters split. That is something that's worth studying. The other thing is the Democrats have crushed the Republicans when it comes to the use of technology. In 2008, in 2012, the Obama campaign especially put to shame the Republicans when it comes to using technology to reach out, identify, organize, and then turn out on election day or in early voting your votes. And the Republicans promised they were going to recover in the technological war of elections. And this is the first test of their new technology. So we may learn something about that.
So speaking of technology, is your magic wall all excited, John, about this afternoon and tonight or no?
Oh, it's just we can't wait, right? I guess, except I'd be very reluctant to use the magic wall because you're talking about Pensacola and the Florida coast here, and a lot of people are probably freezing. And the second I went to Florida, they would want me to go where.
Fine,
so,
fair enough. Okay,
we'll
so John.
We'll be judicious.
John, if we're supposed to write down in pencil any conclusions or any forecasts about Florida, should we do the same with the CPAC results the other day, the Conservative Political Action Conference? Top vote getter yet again is Rand Paul. Chris Christie appears to be on a rehabilitation tour, got a standing ovation when he trashed people like you and your colleagues in the media, I guess us too, indirectly. Does this matter what happens at this meeting of conservative activists?
Not, again, in any huge and profound way. I think from a morale standpoint, Governor Christie has to feel good about going into a room that he was not even invited to come last year, and he got a relatively good reception. He still has to get through this investigation, and there are some big developments happening in that that will give us bigger clues beyond CPAC pretty soon. And then he still has to, you know, if he runs, if he recovers enough to think he's a viable candidate, he'll not only have to run and keep explaining Bridgegate, but remember, he was already going to have a steep hill explaining his support for some gun controls, for example. And that's one of the reasons he did emphasize his anti-abortion or pro-life record, depending on which phraseology listeners might use, at this conference. And that was a clear shift in his emphasis. But what he was trying to say is, I may not talk about this every day as governor of New Jersey because my job there is to balance the budget and worry about schools and worry about the recovery from Sandy. But don't call me a moderate. I'm with you on these issues. I just might not talk about them every day. And that's interesting. It shows you that he understands Iowa and South Carolina, and he's trying to move right, or at least remind people of his right position, right meaning conservative. I'm not saying right meaning correct. That's up to the voters, not me, but on these social issues. So that was interesting. My personal take is the biggest winner out of CPAC was not Rand Paul. He was expected to win the straw poll. He won by a big margin, so he gets a little bit of a boost out of this. But was Rick Perry, who got a very good reception in an early morning speech, who was a disaster as a candidate in 2012. But remember, if Ted Cruz is running and Rand Paul is running and Rick Santorum is running, you've got two current and one former senators there. If Christie is damaged and Jeb Bush does not run, who's the governor? Governors tend to win these things. And so Perry can raise money. Yes, he was horrible last time out, but you know, Ronald Reagan ran more than once. Bob Dole ran more than once. Mitt Romney ran more than once. If you want to talk about somebody who may be at least making early progress in a rehabilitation tour, I would keep your eye on Rick Perry.
So if he's the real winner, I assume Dr. Seuss was the real loser. Is that the conclusion? For those who don't know, Sarah Palin did a rendition of Green Eggs and Ham. You don't have to comment, John. We can move.
I do not like your health care plan. I do not like you. You know what? She's entertaining and she's colorful and she's still a great fundraiser and a draw, if you will. If you're a conservative and you schedule an event with Sarah Palin, you're going to get the people to turn out. Is she relevant in the issues debate? The party's going through a big issues debate, whether it's about defense policy, whether it's about spending policy, whether it's about military and defense spending, not just interventionist versus retreat. The party's gone through a number of fascinating policy debates on a number of issues, and she's, in my view, just simply not relevant to those. She doesn't say anything that moves the dial. Is she a fundraising appeal, and does she give a colorful speech? You betcha.
Well, you know,
you betcha.
Very good, John. We're talking to John King from CNN. You know, you mentioned just a couple of minutes ago about the Republicans talking about getting more with it in terms of technology because after getting kind of clobbered by the Democrats in the Obama election. But one of the things they also talked about was this more outreach to voters that they need to win nationally, more women, more African Americans, more Latinos.
More young voters.
Yes. And there's a sense out of this CPAC thing, I get the sense anyway, that this is not happening yet. Or not happening enough?
I think that's a fair assessment. Again, this is one organization within a conservative family and then a Republican family. And those are not always the same thing. Remember, some conservatives don't like the Republican Party institutionally. Some libertarians who are at CPAC don't consider themselves to be Republicans, even though they probably vote for the Republican nominee for president in most cases, especially if they're Rand or Ron Paulites. But they did have a couple of panel discussions on this, and they were very poorly attended. Most of this is policy. You need to make a commitment that you care about Latinos and their issues and African Americans and their issues and younger voters and their issues. And you need to go into their community and talk to them. And you need to let them talk to you even if you disagree with them. So a panel in and of itself is not a big deal. However, if you know you're in such a ditch and if you know you have an image problem and you schedule a panel on these critical issues, well, then you better make sure you fill the room. I mean, that's just politics 101. And have a lively discussion and show that you mean it. Not just that you put it on the schedule because you knew if you didn't put it on the schedule, people would say they don't care about, black people or Latinos or young people or women. And so I do think they failed sort of the credibility test of that they, I'm not saying that they're not genuine in acknowledging the problem and they're not genuine in saying they need to do something about it. But if you're going to have this event and you know the national media is watching you, then you have to be more careful and you have to pull it off and you have to, whip people into shape and get them into the room. So I did think they failed in that regard. And this is more of a challenge for the candidates, not the organization. But if you're talking about, we're a year plus removed from the 2012 election, can the Republicans put on a piece of paper three or four tangible things to show progress in this regard? I think the answer to that, and I'd be happy to be proven wrong, but I think the answer is no.
You know, John, let's talk briefly, if we can, John King from CNN, about a guy who probably would not be the kind of red meat throwing guy for CPAC. Former United States Senator from Massachusetts. We reported last week that he had had conversations with his family about how he was actively considering the race. Then a poll came out in the Boston Herald and Suffolk University showing Scott Brown going from a dead heat maybe a month ago to a modest double digit, modest meaning a little over 10, 12, 13 something point deficit to Gene Shaheen. You talked about it over the weekend. What's your sense? What are you hearing about Scott Brown's deliberations and likely outcomes in terms of a Senate race from New Hampshire?
This one I find fascinating because all indications are that he has decided he's going to run. And by all indications, I mean I'm told that they have an agreement now to put on the payroll of a Senate campaign, a Brown for Senate campaign in New Hampshire, a guy who most recently was Kelly Ayotte. She's the Republican senator from New Hampshire, her field director. And he's going to be the field director in New Hampshire organizing a Brown for Senate campaign. He's a proven organizer in the state of New Hampshire, the kind of guy you need. I was also told last night, and I haven't been able to pin this down completely yet, but that somebody from the Chris Christie reelection campaign organization in New Jersey was going to come up to New Hampshire and be part of the Brown team, most likely as the campaign manager. I know a number of grassroots Republican activists in New Hampshire who say they have received calls either from Scott Brown or from people very close to him saying, we know you've been frustrated. We know it's taken a while, but he's going to run. He's going to have official word pretty soon. The most fascinating part of this is when you talk to these people, even they don't quite believe it. They want to see him say it publicly, or they want to see him file the candidacy papers because, you know, he's become sort of known as Hamlet on the Merrimack up there.
That's a great line.
It's like, you know, just do it. He's got this trip scheduled to Iowa in April, and some of his people say he wants to wait till after the Iowa trip, you know, to file his candidacy papers in New Hampshire. Well, you know, that poll should tell you one thing. Is Gene Shaheen gettable? Yes, she is. In this election year, just about anybody's gettable. But she's not a dynamo as a public communicator, but she's a pretty good politician. She's a former governor of her state. She knows her state. You're not going to beat her without running a really hard race. And we know Scott Brown's capable of running that race. He did it in Massachusetts, and he beat the odds. But he's going to have to work his tail off. He'll have a primary first, and then he'll have a formidable candidate in Gene Shaheen. There's a lot of frustration in New Hampshire. But the smart people I talk to who don't blow smoke say that when they go into that camp now, meaning Scott Brown and the people closest to him, that the indications are now that he has decided to make the run in New Hampshire. But, you know, forgive me, I'm in the facts business, and I need to see it.
I'm with you. Hey, last thing from me, John. I told Marjorie this morning that I had read something at dawn about this being the worst Congress ever. So I Googled it, and I printed out something for Marjorie. It was from the Washington Post, and it turns out it was the wrong article. It said the worst Congress ever, but it was an article from 2012. And then I Googled again and found an article from today on thehill.com saying worst Congress ever.
Recurring theme.
Is that, I mean, if you were asked, you're about to be asked, is this the worst Congress ever in terms of accomplishment and partisanship and all those sort of things, John King?
If your goal is to get things done, I think without a doubt the answer is yes. Remember, there are some voters out there who so don't like Obama and so don't like, quote-unquote, you know, big government, what they perceive to be big government, that they're almost happy with the government. You know, when the government shut down, they were almost happy. So there are some voters out there who would say this is a successful Congress. But in terms of creating, look, do they have to do big, grand things like immigration reform and entitlement reform? Those are certainly problems that, in my view, and I think in the country's view, need to be addressed. But that the voters judge things on that. One of the things they have to do is to just give public confidence that they can, you know, safely, securely, and adequately and competently run the government. And I don't think there's any such confidence out there. So I have no qualms and would not waste a lot of time researching the counter-argument to anyone who describes this as the worst Congress ever. I would put it this way. When you say 2010, you know, it keeps going. The first rule of holes is to stop digging. And these guys keep digging.
Hey, John, before you go.
Don't you have some Red Sox?
Yeah, I do. Opening day is in Baltimore. You going to opening day?
You know, I work in Washington. I don't think my bosses can listen to you guys live, but they can certainly go online and download it. So, you know, you're asking me to disclose classified potential information about secret movement.
I think we've got the answer,
okay.
John.
Okay.
If the beer is cold and the dogs are hot, I have a duty as an American, don't I?
I think you do. Okay. Hey, John King, great to talk to you as always. Speak to you next week.
Thank you very much, John King, who is CNN's chief national correspondent.
The dogs are hot.
And host of the terrific new Sunday morning show, Inside Politics. Up next, Lawrence Mayor Daniel Rivera's new City Hall directive. No sweatsuits, no shirts, no spandex. Sprucing up the city's image by way of a dress code. We'll debate it up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Edgar B. Herwick III here from the WGBH Curiosity Desk. Now, we've all heard that sea levels are rising, but scientists say that here in Boston, they're rising 4 times faster than the global average. So what does that mean for us? Join me and some of the region's top scientists right here at WGBH on March 28th for a live panel discussion about climate change here in New England, part of WGBH's Smart Conversations series. Limited tickets are available at wgbh.org/events.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Lahey Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at laheyhealth.org. That's laheyhealth.org. And Northeastern University, where faculty, students, and alumni turn innovative ideas into solutions, and solutions into economic growth and prosperity. Northeastern is proud to support Innovation Hub on WGBH, Saturday at 10 a.m.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. You have something you want to say?
I just want to make a small correction.
What's that?
Well, we were going into the segment. I said that the new mayor up in Lawrence has a dress code at City Hall. You're going to explain it.
Yeah,
I didn't mean to say that no shirts are allowed.
Oh, you did say that,
yeah,
didn't you?
You can wear your shirt.
Okay, fine. Good. Thank you for
that. Want to be clear on that.
Well, since you brought it up, in an effort to change the city's image, Lawrence Mayor Daniel Rivera, I'm actually dying to meet him, is banning casual clothing at City Hall. Employees can no longer wear, and this is on the list, spandex, pajamas, sweatsuits, bib overalls, and other leisure wear.
Who wears bib overalls?
Who wears pajamas to City Hall?
Well, you see a lot of kids in pajamas, so maybe they're getting their
first
job.
Kids are not working at City Hall.
Well, they might be going to their first job at City Hall in their pajamas.
In any case, ties are mandatory for men. One of the unions is upset with that. So for a city that faces a lot of challenges, does this seem like a superficial fix, or does every detail count? Then step back a little bit. Does a dress code at a workplace make a difference? Does it make a difference for the customers, whoever they are, or the clients? Does it make a difference in terms of attitude internally? By the way, we invited the mayor on, but he has a tricky schedule today. He can't join us. If any of you have seen city employees wearing pajamas in Lawrence, we'd like you to call us 877-301-8970. You and I have fought for years on the radio about dress codes in schools. We're not talking schools
today.
No,
we're not.
We're talking adults at the workplace, and he is not, these are not, he's a, every time I've seen him on television, he was wearing khakis and a blazer.
That's his uniform.
That's
he wears
his essential.
The blazer, the khakis, and the tie. That's correct.
But when you come from a city that has had such serious problems with its former mayor, who still has problems, Willie Lantigua.
He's in a pothole scandal at the moment.
He is. It seems to me that this is the kind of thing, as long as he doesn't go too far, that's a nice statement to the public that comes to City Hall.
It's City Hall, and usually you're not going there for a happy situation. You got to, you know, it's time consuming. You got to get some kind of license. You got to do something with your taxes or whatever it is.
Right.
So I think it's great in City Hall. I mean, I sound a little hypocritical because I have worn jeans to work on many occasions. You're wearing jeans today. I'm not wearing jeans today.
I'm not going to Lawrence City Hall today.
Right. You're not a City Hall employee.
Going to wear pajamas, but I decided to wear jeans. I decided to be a little more dressed up for today's festivities.
So every once in a while, Jim thrills us all when he wears his black sweatsuit.
I've worn that in years, but thank you.
It's a very fetching look.
You know, generally,
but, I mean,
you
shouldn't wear sweatsuits at City Hall.
No, you shouldn't.
I think wear the tie if you're a guy, and if you're a woman, just don't wear jeans, except for maybe casual Friday.
Well, yeah, and he's talking about a casual day potential, too. By the way, in normal settings, my attitude is you treat adults like adults, and you trust their judgment. And if somebody exhibits horrible judgment and wears pajamas to work, then I think you sit him or her down and say, this is not like a sleep facility. This is a work facility. But short of that, my general position is, let if you trust someone enough to hire them to work for you, then trust them enough to dress appropriately. But I guess in certain settings, particularly if there's this kind of history, which sounds like, I mean, wearing spandex and pajamas, I still can't get over this to work. I assume they were doing it or he wouldn't have issued this edict, is probably a good thing. But again, if you want to comment on Lawrence, it's fine. But we want to step back a little bit and talk about both your experience and your view on dress codes at work.
Depends where you work. I mean, there are certain places, if you were going to go in and hire a lawyer to deal with your closing or something like that, and you walked in and he was in a T-shirt and jeans, I don't know.
What if he had an open – he didn't have a tie, which is what you're required to have if you're a man now at Lawrence City Hall.
That's not such a big deal anymore. Barack Obama, the president of the United States, runs around without a tie.
So why should Rivera require his employees to have a tie? Why can't they just be neatly dressed and that sort of thing?
Well, you know, I wouldn't be upset if he said, you know, khakis and a button-down shirt or something. But I don't think you want to see people in T-shirts. Shirts and jeans that you got to do serious business with. It just doesn't look good. And there's the other problem, too, of young women. We've talked about this before, but because young women, as you may have noticed, in high school dress in a very provocative way, and then they go to a job, and they're still dressed in the very provocative way.
Tell the Herald story you told in the past.
Beautiful-looking young woman at the Herald that was right out of college, and she got a job there. And she was gorgeous, but she had really low cleavage.
Mm-hmm. At work.
At work. And, I mean, she sat right near me, and I was distracted, and I'm a woman, and the guys didn't know what to do with themselves. And it was really funny because they didn't know how to solve the problem. They certainly couldn't have a male manager speak to her about how this was inappropriate office attire, much as they loved looking at her.
So what did they do? Ask her to do it?
No, they got one of my former bosses who was like 9 months pregnant.
A woman to go up to her?
Yes, she called her into her office and said, you can't dress like that in the office. But a lot of people don't know how to dress anymore, so you need these kind of directives.
But see, as a general rule, this gets back to what I said. I mean, I assume you would agree, the worst dressed people in probably any profession I've ever met are people in the media. It is unbelievable. People go to gubernatorial press conferences in T-shirts and maybe a jacket and jeans and that sort of thing. And by the way, the governor's going to be with us on Thursday, speaking of gubernatorial Thursday noon one.
He's a fine.
Well, occasionally he has a little vest on.
It's
the emergency manager
emblem.
Thing.
He's big into emblems.
But again, as a general rule, my position is treat people like grown-ups. And if any of them violate the grown-up rule, like that woman you mentioned, then on a one-on-one basis, politely tell him or her how to dress. But I think in Lawrence, this is basically making a statement to the people. There's a new sheriff in town, well, specifically a new mayor in town, and we're going to do things differently. 877-301-8970. How do you feel about dress codes? Do you have one at work? And does it rankle you? I have to say, if there was a dress code here or at the Herald, would that bother you? It would bother me.
A dress code?
Yeah, I think we're expected I assume the personal manual here says dress appropriately.
If you're a reporter and you're going out to the scene of a fire or you're kind of in rough and tumble situations a lot, and that's why I think when the inspectional guys at the City Hall in Lawrence are saying, don't want to go out to be doing some problem with the sewer system or, you know, doing plumbing in a jacket and tie.
Well, he had a solution for that. The mayor said change your clothes.
Exactly,
right.
Which I think is a reasonable solution. You know, Christopher just sent an email, and this is a good point. Mark Zuckerberg is famous for running around.
Well, Steve Jobs, too.
In T-shirts and jeans. Jobs had the turtleneck. Remember, he always wore the black turtleneck and the jeans. But that's right. Mark Zuckerberg, one of the richest men in the world, most successful men in the world, he's Mr. Jeans, hoodie, and T-shirt.
But that's a statement. I mean, that is sort of the dress code for that world, is it not?
Yes.
If you overdress, then you're clearly not part of that world. In any case, let's take some calls. 877-301-8970. Let's go to New Hampshire, where Ellen is on the phone. Hello, Ellen. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you for taking my call.
Hey.
Well, Mark Zuckerberg is a privately owned. It is out on the you can buy stock in it, but it's a privately owned company. When you're working for a city, let's say you're sitting on an airplane and the pilot comes in and he or she is dressed in these really yucky pants and this torn apart shirt.
Yeah, forget it.
How are you going to feel about that person flying
terrible
somewhere?
Terrible.
Are you going to trust them?
No.
These are public employees, and they should be they should reasonably dress in decent attire.
Yeah, by the way, you correct yourself. Facebook is a publicly owned company, but it's a private sector company, is your
That's
point.
Right.
And he can do what he wants there. And it is part of the sort of MO of that generation and that industry. But you make a great point about the pilot. Ellen, thank you for the call. Sully Sullenberger,
look,
for example. Can you imagine? I saw him on CNN
don't
last night.
Don't they look great when you see the pilots at the door and you're getting in and getting out and they're all that crisp uniforms? Cops, when they have those very crisp, beautifully pressed uniforms, they have to send them out to be pressed. It wouldn't look like that. They did it themselves. They always look really good, particularly state troopers. I think it's the boots.
Okay, let's move on from there. Sean, you are in Dedham. You are next on Boston Public Radio. You wear a uniform, do you not, Sean?
Yes, I do, Jimmy, and I look pretty good in it. Hey, Jimmy, I don't see what the problem is. Last time I was up in Lawrence, I had to pay a parking ticket, and the lady helped me out. You know, she was wearing a shirt that said it's a gang thing, and her sweatpants said it's juicy. I didn't see a problem with that, Jimmy. I mean, cleavage was down to her ankles.
Okay,
I mean,
Sean.
Can I tell you something?
Well, a lot of jokes are made about Lawrence. They made a pretty dramatic statement dumping Lantigua and putting the city councilor in office. And the guy is trying to clean up, right? So go back to pay another ticket and let us know how it goes, Sean, will you? Oh, Sean's gone. Sean, thank you for the call.
Stephen says he thinks we can find quite a few shots of Sarah Palin in bib overalls. What do you think?
But there's certain settings where it's perfectly fine. It is not appropriate, assuming that they did it, at Lawrence City Hall or any other city hall, for a person who interacts with the public to be wearing bib overalls unless they're in some rural community somewhere.
You know
You
know what I really hate?
What's that?
If you're going to go out and really spend a lot of money at a very fancy restaurant and you go in there and people are in like T-shirts and...
Well, I don't mind the tape. If you're clean, don't be an old fuddy-duddy. I mean,
I
if it turns out you're
duddy.
Clean and you're...
I think the entree should be 20 and under and you can wear what you want. 25 and over.
You have to have a dress code.
Yeah, it's a little bit more dressy.
Let's go to Jane and Marion. You were next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about dress codes in light of the action taken by the new mayor of Lawrence, Massachusetts. Hi there, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
We're excellent. Thank you for asking.
Great. I do agree with the dress code. And just to sort of... give a little background. I think when he refers to the pajamas, I think he's referring to the knit pants that a lot of the younger kids are wearing. They wear the knit pajama pants. So
yes.
That's what he's referring to.
Oh, yeah. I think I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, a lot of kids, unless schools have a dress code, a lot of kids go to school in those ridiculous
and
things.
And in terms of like the spandex, it's the yoga pants, and that's in fashion now, too. But my experience with both of those situations is... each of my daughters went to a different high school. One went to a public high school, and the other one went to an independent school. I was on the school committee for the public high school, and I now work at the independent school.
Oh.
So I have a little bit of experience seeing both of those worlds. And it's fascinating, but I think it's like when you put on a uniform before a game, you act differently, you feel differently.
Yeah.
You feel more professional. You sort of... walk the walk. And I see it at the school that I'm working at now. Kids have to wear jacket and tie, dress pants. And it's not a uniform, but it's a stringent dress code. And I definitely see that they just bring a different game.
You have a change. Well, we don't want to debate the school thing, but you spoke to it eloquently, and obviously you have a huge amount of experience in both private schools and now independent schools. And Marjorie and I have fought about this on the air for 15 years. My attitude is one of the few ways, within certain bounds. I'm not suggesting that we're pajamas or gang attire.
I told you the solution.
But it's a way that kids, isn't their clothing a dramatic way that kids can show their independence? I mean, isn't there value in that too?
Yes, I agree with that. And again, the school setting is different than the work setting, as you mentioned.
Yeah, well, I was even talking about in schools, as long as
Jane, you know, in the Catholic schools, that was a big joke that the girls would decorate their saddle shoes. They'd have different kinds of decor on the saddle shoes. What?
I went to a Catholic school, so I understand that. And I get the benefit, too, of the level playing field with the uniform.
Yeah.
But in terms of the workplace, I like to watch our Board of Selectmen meetings on cable TV. And when during the summer, they're not in, I call it dress code, they're not in jackets and ties. And I look at them and they look unprofessional. When they have jackets and ties on, I feel like they look smarter, they act smarter, they make a better decision.
Can I tell you something? You can say a woman who watches alderman meetings on cable access.
Very impressive.
Is my kind of woman. Jane, thank you for the call. By the way, the best viewing if you live in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. I haven't done it in a few years since my city council career.
Yeah.
Watching the city council on Monday night.
Can't beat it.
On CCTV.
Doesn't
there is nothing.
Get
no, it's totally true.
That.
It is.
How about
you
men?
Ever watch the Brookline Selectmen
no,
or
I have
the
never,
town meeting?
I have not.
Oh,
I used to cover them as
missing.
A young reporter.
I know you did. Didn't you cover
torture.
The poll and sewer commission or something?
I began my illustrious career covering the Westport Septic Lagoon Commission.
Is that really true?
They were going to put a big cesspool
That's
in Westport.
Great.
That's where I began. Perk tests and cesspools. It was really exciting.
History,
That's
yes.
right. But you know what? How about this in the fancy restaurant with the $25, $30 entrees? Men in sleeveless T-shirts.
Well,
that's
a problem.
That's attractive,
no,
isn't
it's a problem. You're obsessing on one particular thing that we're not actually even talking about, but that's perfectly fine. You just keep going at that. Dan, you're in Worcester. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call, Dan. Hi.
Hi, Maggie and Jim. How you doing?
We're great.
Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
Jim, I remember you when you were wearing your Zorro outfit back at the other place. And
occasionally I'd come in with my Zorro thing and a mask. Yeah, I would, but it was infrequent, Dan.
But that spoke volumes about your attire. However, I too am a product of parochial education and do believe in the dress code. And I find today just totally, I don't know, unprofessional with people who come to work, especially if they're working for a city or a municipality or what have you, and they're all disheveled and they're kind of like they just don't really give a damn about their appearance, and that kind of throws me off to the professionalism. I agree with the lady who just called.
Now, Dan,
I'm a plumber. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to ask you how you differentiated yourself when you were in Catholic school. Did you do something fancy with your khaki pants, or what did you do?
No, I followed the rest of the crowd. We had some real tough French nuns, and if you stepped out of the line, you got whacked.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
But I grew up to be a plumber, and I've been one all my life. But I'm dressed better than a lot of people I see going off to professional jobs who are where they're in the public eye. I just don't understand it. But that's my two cents.
Best dressed plumber in Worcester. Hey, Dan, it's a pleasure to talk to you as always. Thanks so much for the call.
We're talking about this because up in Lawrence, the new mayor, Daniel Rivera, has decided that people should no longer wear bib overalls, sweatpants, spandex,
Bermuda shorts,
and pajamas to work at City Hall. And we're debating if this is a good idea. I do think it's a good idea.
Do you see that in the Lawrence Eagle Tribune story? There's a 45. I don't know who gets this. The city of Lawrence spends $45,000 a year on employee clothing allowances.
Yeah.
And the implication in this, the opening line of the story, the implication in the story by Keith Eddings in the Eagle Tribune from March 1st is, I guess, that virtually everybody who works in City Hall gets some small piece of that. And the mayor's argument is you can buy more than T-shirts or the things you mentioned for that. You know, if they get a bit of an allowance, then mm-hmm. he's got an even stronger argument than I thought he did to begin with, don't you think?
Yes, I think he does have a bigger, better argument. I think that's distressing, too. A lot of people don't like to see men in shorts.
I know. It's a look that really is not, it's not that attractive. I would agree in most cases. Glenn, you're in a car.
You like them.
You're next on, I mean, certain days.
When you see Jim behind that anchor desk over at New England Cable News.
Can I tell you something?
Shorts.
One of the great revelations of my life when I started working in New England Cable News years ago, and I finally got paired with the legendary Chet Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I came in, and behind the anchor desk, the legendary Chet Curtis had this beautiful jacket and shirt. I mean, he looked perfect, and I walked over to sit down next to him. Shorts. It was literally. It took me days to recover, and then I figured if Chet Curtis can do it, and he didn't do it often. Let's be fair.
Yeah.
Though he didn't wear socks. Do you know that he did not wear socks? He was a loafer and no socks
kind of
guy.
Well, that's sort of a Yasmin kind of thing.
Yeah, and
he was
a boat guy.
But the thing is, of course, you didn't see the shorts.
No,
if you
did.
Were
of course, and he would never even think of it if you did.
It was behind the anchor desk, so it would be different. It's like, you know, judges. You know, you don't know what they're wearing underneath their robes because they're wearing the robe, so you have no idea.
It's one of the reasons they don't want cameras in the courtroom, by the way, on the screen. Court because of the rumors you've heard.
I tell you,
okay,
Antonin Scalia, he's a wild man.
He sure is.
Nancy from Spencer, what do you think about the dress code, Nancy?
Who?
Hi, Nancy.
Yes, I have a different perspective. I worked in a technical field for many years,
yep.
And as a manager, a woman amongst maybe, you know, 10, 12 other guys, always guys, they wore technical field, you know, they wore like blue jeans. Basically.
Yeah.
But I wanted to show that I was, you know, professional. And so I always wore, you know, nice clothes, the nicest I could afford, you know, Talbots or whatever. And, you know, I was always facing the dilemma, do I want to be one of the guys dressed in the blue jeans, or do I go for, you know, the more professional look, the pantsuit, you know, and coordinated scarf and all that. But, you know, at the time, pantsuits were worn by Hillary Clinton, and maybe that was a bad look. I don't know. But anyway, I don't know if it won me points or lost me points, and it was always confusing for me. I think it's confusing for women in the workplace, too. Similar.
Nancy, how are you, what was the end? How, when you did dress differently from the men, how did they... Did you get a different reaction because they thought you were trying to one-up them, or did they just accept you as you were?
You know, I think because I had a sort of a happy-go-lucky, easygoing nature, I hope they accepted me for who I was.
So too, yeah.
But I did have, you know, some comments like, oh, another Talbot suit. And so, you know, you know, some guys actually could tell, you know, the different brand names.
That's pretty impressive.
Nancy, thank you for the call.
You know, Nancy brings up a great point, too, about how the rules for women in the workplace have changed. I mean, back in the late 70s, early 80s, suits. You're supposed to wear suits. You're supposed to look like a man, so if you had a big bow around your neck, you know. And then now you can be much sexier looking at work. A lot of people have on short skirts, or they have on not, you know, really crazy cleavage, but they go sleeveless. I mean, the Michelle Obama thing, you look on the television now, almost every anchor woman is in a sleeveless dress.
I know that.
Dress.
Actually, I've noticed that.
Yeah,
that's true.
Very, very, very sexy. So you can be taken seriously as a professional woman in much more revealing outfits than you certainly could before. Let's go to
Glenn in the car.
Hi. Oh, is it Glenn or Gwen? Yeah,
Glenn.
Hi, Glenn.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Pleasure. Enjoy your show immensely.
Thank you.
I wish you were on longer. I own a service company that I employ generally younger people. I had to get them all uniforms because I had to bite the bullet and take out of my profits. And I have stores that people come in and they just, the way that people dress these days is just ridiculous.
Oh, give us some examples, Glenn.
Those see-through, they call them yoga pants, but these things that girls wear, and generally the people wear them, and I'm overweight, so I shouldn't be wearing them. But you get people who shouldn't be wearing clothes and low-cut things and tattoos, and it's just you have to cover up if you're in a food service thing. There's a certain appearance people expect. But then on the other side, Lauren, that's ridiculous. It's like putting lipstick on a pig. You just get, he's got other fights to fight.
But Glenn, can I interrupt you? Let me interrupt you before you finish your thought. That was the initial thought I had, that there's so many huge issues confronting Rivera, the new mayor. But you know what it's analogous to, and I'm sure you remember this. Do you remember when one of the first acts, I hope I get this right, of the former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani, was to get rid of the squeegee guys who would spray soap on your window when you came to a red light, and then you basically had to pay them to wash it off? It was the smallest problem facing New York City, but he consciously did it to show it's a new city. This is a new way of running things here. And don't you get the sense that that's a statement Rivera's making? He's a smart guy. He knows there are far bigger issues, but he's presenting a different face to the public. Don't you think that's what's going on, Glenn?
I think it's a great idea, but implementing it with unions and then that $45,000, I sit on a board for a town, and we negotiate contracts all the time for municipalities.
Yeah.
And it's the police, it's the fire. They all get
That's right.
Sometimes DPWs. Those are built into the contract.
Yep. Yeah.
Now, they're going to fight the other unions that don't get that. Now, everybody's going to get it, and hopefully it will work. And I agree with you, Jim, 100%. But we live in reality.
Yeah.
So hopefully he's not known as the guy that tried to get everybody to wear pantsuits than cleaning up the streets of Lawrence.
That's a fine point, Dan. With Glenn, thanks for a great call.
Jim, you raised a great point about the whole idea of the squeegees. I always forget if it's James Q. Wilson or James O. Wilson, but whoever it was that came up with the criminologist that came up with the broken windows theory.
I don't know.
If people say, well, what difference does it make if there's a few broken windows on the street? Well, it makes a lot of difference because it looks like a street where no one's paying attention and no one's caring for the street. So cleaning up broken windows, getting rid of old cars that are dumped places, clean clean and orderly makes a difference in terms of crime, and it probably makes a difference in terms of the atmosphere with which people go into City Hall and how seriously – it says something about how seriously people in City Hall take their job.
Oh, I said it. I must agree. By the way, one of our colleagues just whispered into my headphones that it's James Q.
James Q.
Record.
Thank you very much. I knew it was James something Wilson, and it's James Q.
Let's squeeze one more
in. I wonder what his middle name is.
Rama, you were, I think it's Rama. You're in Newburyport. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call.
Hey, you're welcome, and good afternoon. Hi. Yep.
Hi.
Hi, Marjorie. Stole my thunder. Yes. Just what you said. It brings a lot of respect back to Lawrence, and there's a lot of potential for Lawrence. I want to take it another step, and I love what he's doing in Lawrence, another step further, if I may.
Sure.
I want to ban yoga pants and stretchy pants and spandex pants. Women do not realize what they're doing to men. Ugh, they should not be wearing that in public. It's excruciating.
Okay, on that note, no, I don't ask him why. Right? I think it's best we'd leave it right where it is.
If they're bad or they're good. I just want to know if you like, if they're bad or good.
Go ahead, Rama. Luckily, he's gone. I think that was an unsafe place to go. Rama, thank you for your call. And by the way, we hope to get Daniel Rivera in here quite soon. He had a conflict this morning, but new mayor of Lawrence.
Christopher maintains that the really serious newswomen like Christine Amanpour are not going sleeveless, Jim. I don't know if that's
true. She's great, by the way. Is she great?
She is great. Okay, up next, we are joined in a couple of minutes by MIT economist Jonathan Gruber, the man who was instrumental in designing, both Romney Care and the Affordable Care Act. We're going to talk to him about both up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We're fairly certain that we can offer these open online courses for a tuition rate that's lower than what we charge for a traditional course.
On Campus, the WGBH News Higher Ed Desk on WGBH Radio.
Join some of the region's top scientists right here at WGBH on March 28th for a live panel discussion about climate change here in New England, part of WGBH's Smart Conversations series. Tickets are available at wgbh.org/events.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And the BSO, presenting Christoph von Dohnányi and Yefim Bronfman in 3 all Beethoven programs, March 13th to 22nd. With a lecture series exploring the composer's remarkable legacy. Details at bso.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Obamacare, from the moment it was signed into law through its rocky online rollout, has been the punching bag for the GOP and the punchline to endless late-night jokes, so much so that President Obama, he's even in on it.
Have you heard of healthcare.gov?
Here we go. Okay, let's get this out of the way. What did you come here to plug?
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to say that I wouldn't be with you here today if I didn't have something to plug. Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. That's the thing that doesn't work. Why would you get the guy that created the Zune to make your website?
Healthcare.gov works great now.
Now, if you have not seen this, that's just a little excerpt from this spectacular back and forth with Barack Obama, really was him, with Zach Galifianakis, his show Between Two Ferns. Here with us in Studio 3, Between Two Hosts, to explain what the media, politicians, and punditry occasionally get wrong about Obamacare and Romney Care is Jonathan Gruber. Jonathan Gruber is a professor of economics at MIT, who's, I assume you know, advised both Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney and Barack Obama on health care reform. John Gruber, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
So before we get to the debates and what's right and what's wrong, it is amazing that you're one person, and yet you were heavily involved in designing Romney Care and heavily involved in so-called Obamacare. How'd this happen?
Well, I got involved in Romney Care because Governor Romney had a vision for a plan he wanted to do in the state, but he needed someone to sort of put the numbers on it. I was the numbers guy that helped him figure out, could he really afford his vision? Could he cover the people he wanted to cover for the budget he had? And I sort of put the numbers together that said he could. I got together involved in Obamacare because Obamacare was really just Romney Care at the national level. They decided they wanted to follow the same model, so they brought me down to work on it.
Now, so you met both former Governor Romney and Barack Obama.
Yes.
Different styles, different guys.
Yeah, I think both a lot of similarities. Both incredibly competent, incredibly detail-oriented about getting it right, about making sure that things work the right way. I think President Obama is a much more relaxed guy to interact with. What you saw in the Zach Galifianakis thing today is what you get. He's just sort of a really just a very relaxed guy.
Kind of cool. Kind of cool.
He's super cool.
Super cool. I don't think you call Mitt Romney, if you, no matter how much you love him. Cool wouldn't be one of the words you use, right?
Mitt Romney really was impressive.
Yeah.
Very competent, very smart. Really, I think, not what the public saw when he was running for president.
Okay. Now, when he found you, was it because you were somebody who believed in this individual mandate, or did he just have a concept into which you inserted your concept of a mandate that became the centerpiece of that, and one would argue the centerpiece of the Affordable Care Act as well? Which came first?
I mean, really, they came simultaneously. He really believed in the mandate from sort of a moral perspective.
As an individual responsibility?
As an individual responsibility, that people are free riding on the system and we need the mandate to make sure everybody paid their share. I came from economics perspective, where for years our profession has been saying this makes sense as a way to fix insurance markets. So really, when his staff first laid out the plan for me, I said, this is like an economist's dream plan. I love this. And then they brought me in to help sort of flesh it out and put the numbers on it.
So after the fact, everybody knows you're the guy who essentially was the, I don't want to say the brains because it's disparaging to the men behind it, but the brains behind both these plans. When you were invited to meet with the President of the United States, or then, was it candidate Obama at that point?
I first met when it was Senator Obama contemplating a run for the presidency.
And what were you saying to yourself? I mean, was there a piece of you? I mean, you're a very prominent professor, but at the same time, this guy was on his way to becoming the most powerful person in the world, and he was saying that one of the centerpieces of what I'm going to do, should I be elected, is essentially your idea, a little shaped by some of my people as well. How'd you take that? How was that for you?
I think you're making it sound too much about me compared to the way it was. When I first met candidate Obama, he was not an expert in healthcare, and I really went down there to educate him. And I think to his credit, he said, look, I need to learn more about healthcare. And I really sort of gave him sort of an hour seminar on kind of how healthcare works, how we did it in Massachusetts, how the plan works. He really was just in sort of listening and learning mode. And then by the next time I interacted with him, his administration really decided to adopt the Massachusetts model. And there are lots of smart people behind it, and there's lots of people who helped with it. But I think the key thing for your listeners to recognize is we did it first in Massachusetts. And this is an unprecedented example of basing a huge national policy on an experiment that was run in one state. And
well, what's the name of the guy we mentioned a few weeks ago? What's the name of the guy who wrote the book 15 years ago that Weld relied on so much, Laboratories of Democracy? He's a Massachusetts guy.
Oh, gosh.
Essentially, he was making the point. I'll think of his David somebody. I'll think of his name in a minute. But essentially saying, let's see what works on a local level. But part of the criticism, we should get into the substance.
David Osborne.
David Osborne. Thank you very much,
Chelsea. Thank you, Chelsea.
Part of the criticism, I mean, Barack Obama, I assume, would say if he were sitting here, that's exactly right. It worked in Massachusetts. We adapted it to the national level. Mitt Romney would say and has said repeatedly, as you heard during the campaign, let every state design something that works best for that population, those demographics. What's wrong with that state-by-state notion?
Fundamentally, what's wrong and misleading about what Mitt Romney said was he didn't admit the fact that the federal government paid for our law. Okay, so after we got this law in Massachusetts, I then went out and worked with Governor Schwarzenegger to try to do the same thing in California. It was a great experience. He really talks like he does in the movies. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, great.
And, but we got to the point where we had a plan. He was very excited and then suddenly realized they didn't have the money. And why did we have the money in Massachusetts? Because we had a pretty powerful senator you may have heard of named Ted Kennedy. And Ted Kennedy figured out a way to siphon about $500 million a year of federal money to our state. And that became the money that made our law possible. When Mitt Romney, the candidate, said, let the states do it, Mitt Romney, the candidate, didn't say, oh, but by the way, the feds are going to have to pay for it. It'll never work. So really, it had to be federally implemented. The question, just how much freedom to leave the states, the law actually leaves the states quite a bit of freedom. Unfortunately, the states are choosing not to take it.
We're talking to Jonathan Gruber, professor of economics at MIT, who obviously was intimately involved in the creation of Romney Care and the Affordable Care Act. The latest blow – I'm sorry, Marjorie.
I was just going to ask you the thing that really worries me as Citizen Jane over here. The GOP now is running very heavily on, you know, what a disaster Obamacare is and how it's going to be – it's cracking and it's going to fall apart. What do you think? Is this going to survive Barack Obama's presidency?
Yes. I mean, basically, the last chance the GOP had to stop this was the 2012 elections. Once Barack Obama won in 2012, it was over. They can continue to complain and pass ad nauseum in the House of Representatives repeals of this law, but it's done. It's in place. The next chance they would have to fundamentally alter it would be in 2016. By then, you're going to have tens of millions of Americans who are going to benefit from this important law. You're going to have a system where finally, for the first time in 50 years, insurers won't discriminate against people just because they're sick. There's no way they're going to be able to take that away.
But you when know, you're saying when you're saying 2016, you mean a new president?
The only way you get rid of this is for the Republicans to own both houses of Congress and the presidency.
Okay.
So that he doesn't veto whatever comes out of Congress.
Okay.
But the latest argument, there are a couple of arguments on both sides that have materialized lately. The latest and most recent argument for the proponents is for the third successive Gallup poll in a row, there are increased numbers, fewer numbers of people who are uninsured. And while Gallup is not quite ready to make the leap and say, well, we're pretty convinced this is a function of the Affordable Care Act, they're inching closer to that. Just saying it's not just a one poll trend anymore. But the thing they don't answer is who are the people who are joining the ranks of the insured. And you know far better than we do that the critical concern is to those young invincibles, the ones who don't really need health care immediately, at least believe they don't need health care, who will help finance in the short term the health coverage of those who do need it more, older and older Americans. Are they signing up, or is it just the people who need it? Do you have any idea?
We know roughly that they're signing up in similar numbers to what we saw in Massachusetts. What we saw in Massachusetts was initially about 25% of enrollment was people between 18 and 34. As we got to the deadline, that jumped up over 30%.
Does that track their percentage of the population?
And their percentage is currently about 25%. We'll have to see what it is in March as we get close to the deadline. But look, the truth is, what matters is not – there's no right percentage. What matters is what did insurers project when they set their rates. Insurers set rates which were surprisingly low, 16% below what the Congressional Budget Office proposed. When they set those rates, they must have had some assumption on how many young people would sign up. So the key question is when the next round of rates come out in May, how did the young people sign up compared to what the insurers expected?
And if it's lower than what they expected, then the rates are going to skyrocket,
exactly.
Right?
I think skyrocket is unlikely, but they'll go up. And basically how much they'll go up will depend on what mix they see in the population.
On the flip side, so that's the argument that the proponents of the Affordable Care Act have been settling on most is the sign-up rate. The flip side, after the initial problems, obviously, with healthcare.gov, the flip side is the argument that Republicans have adopted that you have almost single-handedly been responding to is this report from the nonpartisan. You have to always say nonpartisan or bipartisan, okay. Congressional Budget Office, or you get – what are those things called? Those little things that prodded. You got a cattle prod applied to you. They have said that the workforce is likely to be reduced by 2 million people by 2017 as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Republicans have said, aha, it's going to cost 2 million jobs. You say, aha, no, it's not quite as you're painting it. Where are the Republicans wrong in their interpretation of that data?
So basically, there are lots of ways this law is going to affect the economy. One way is that fewer people will work. The CBO's right. And that's going to be for two reasons, one good and one bad. The good reason is that there are many people who work today who would prefer not to work, maybe be retired or maybe start in their own new business and not work at a current job, but are afraid to leave their jobs because of fear of losing health insurance.
You call it job lock.
I don't just call it job lock. That's what the literature
term.
Calls
okay.
it.
Yeah.
So basically, if you're a 62-year-old guy, it's time to be on Social Security. You hate your job. You want to be in Social Security. You can't wait. But your 55-year-old wife's a breast cancer survivor, and if you leave your job, she's uninsured. Mm-hmm. You're stuck. Now, after January 1, you're not stuck. Now she can get health insurance. Now you can leave your job, and you're happier. Work is not a moral obligation. Work is something we do if the rewards for that work exceed the cost to us of that work.
So that's the good one.
That's
what's
good
the bad
one? The bad one is that in order to target these benefits to low-income populations, you have to phase them out. So if you were just going to say everyone in America gets free health insurance, well, then that would be great, but that would cost too much. So what you want to do is target it to lower income populations, in particular those below about the typical income in America. But to do that, you've got to phase those benefits out. So as your income goes up, you get less. What that means is that reduces the incentive to work because as your income goes up, you get less benefits. Now, that's not a huge effect, but it's a real effect, and it's part of what CBO is doing. The question is, the answer is either we just give benefits to everyone, which is unaffordable, or we just let people be uninsured, which seems ridiculous. So I think that negative effect has to get weighed against the fact we're to cover 25 to 30 million Americans.
We're talking with Jonathan Gruber. He advised both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama on reforming health care. He's an MIT economics professor. You know, you see these scary stories. There was a particularly scary one in the Boston Globe a few weeks ago out of New Hampshire where people with pretty significant health care problems were going to be driving like 60 and 70 miles to get to a facility that would deal with their problem, which, and if you're 75 and you're up there in 0-degree weather in New Hampshire, this is pretty frightening. Are those situations going to be resolved, or is this just the vision of healthcare going forward?
First of all, none of this affects those over 65.
Okay.
So it's not an issue
for Medicare.
Seniors.
Okay, so say you're 64 then.
Say you're 64. Second of all, consumers will now face a choice between paying very low rates but having a more limited network where they might have to drive further, and paying higher rates and having a broader network where they won't. And that's great. That's what we should all be for. We should be for people facing these choices and understand the implications and understand that, you know, if they want to save a lot of money, then they might have to drive further for their health care. And that's okay. You know, we spend 18% of our economy on health care. If we do nothing about that, it's projected to be 40% of our economy by about 2080. That can't happen.
Okay.
Something has to give. We have to make some hard choices, and this is one of them.
Jonathan Gruber, if John Boehner called you on the phone today and Mitch McConnell was on the other line and said, you know what we're going to do, because we heard you on the radio and we like what you had to say, we're going to give you one shot to change one thing in this Affordable Care Act, and we're not going to vote against it. We're just going to let it happen. What's the one thing a couple of years after the fact, looking back, either for political reasons or miscalculation reasons, is not as you would like it to be? What would that one thing be?
I'm going to have to ask for two.
Okay, so, you may have two.
So the two I'm going to ask for is I'm going to make the mandate penalty tougher. I think the mandate penalty is not as strong as
too
in
low.
Massachusetts.
Too low.
It's too low. It should be tougher, especially in the first couple of years.
And just so people are clear, because your fear is that people are going to opt out and
exactly.
just pay the penalty.
How much is it?
The first year, it's the bigger of $95 or 1% of your income.
Oh.
So it's really tiny. By the third year, it's the bigger of $700 or 2.5% of your income. So it becomes more meaningful. But even still, that's a bit low. So I would raise that.
Okay.
The second thing I would do is the place where I think the law is weakest on helping people is sort of lower middle income people, people with maybe individuals with incomes between about $15,000 and $30,000 don't get enough help in terms of offsetting the cost of their medical care. They can be in plans with a $2,000 deductible. That's pretty hard to afford on a $15,000 income. So I would increase the help that would go there.
You know, let's move closer to home.
By the way, Boehner just hung up on you.
Yeah.
I just want you to know. It's just right in the middle of the call. It was unbelievable. Yeah.
You were there, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, up at the State House the day that Jean Yang, this is the Massachusetts Health Connector woman, started crying, basically, up in Beacon Hill because she said her employees were so embarrassed to be working there. What did you make of that?
Well, what I made of that is Jean is a woman who cares a lot about getting it right. And she's got a tough job. And the connector, which bears only a very small share of the blame, has gotten all of the blame. So what went wrong in Massachusetts? We've had a big problem with our website. What went wrong was really simultaneously three things. First of all, we were too ambitious. We tried to have by far a better website than any other state was having, and it was probably too ambitious a plan. Second of all, we had a process in the government to run the procurement of the website, which wasn't very sensible, and that it wasn't just the connector running it. It was the connector and MassHealth and UMass. And it wasn't clear who was in charge, and the contract was getting conflicting orders from different groups.
Okay.
Not dissimilar to healthcare.gov.
Not dissimilar.
Too many chefs and
chef. And third of all, not similar to healthcare.gov, we had a terrible contractor. CGI just did not do a good job, which worked hand in hand with the fact that the chain of command wasn't clear, which led to the problems. I think we've resolved those now, and that we have a clear chain of command with Sarah Islin in charge. I think
she's the Blue Cross woman that the governor brought in.
She's terrific. I think we've got a good plan in place. Look, the federal government, once they got their act together, fixed it pretty quickly. And I think we'll do a similar thing here in Massachusetts.
Charlie Baker, who's running for governor, he's a Republican running for governor. I'm sure you know him. He thinks that Massachusetts should get a waiver to be accepted from health care. Why is he wrong?
It's easy to say that, you know, after the fact, after the website didn't work well and stuff.
No, he said, in all fairness to Baker, he's been saying this for
quite
a long time.
Fair enough. I mean, basically, the reason I think he's wrong is a couplefold. First of all, there are good features in the federal law we didn't have in Massachusetts. In particular, people from 3 to 4 times the poverty line in Massachusetts often couldn't afford health care and weren't getting help to pay it. Under the federal law, they'll get federal tax credits. That's a meaningful part of the population that gets helped. Second of all, there's a real reason why you want the system integrated nationally. In particular, multi-state companies benefit from having one system, not different systems in different states. I think it's going to promote business in Massachusetts to make sure we have a system that works well integrating nationally.
Okay. Jonathan Gruber.
Before you go, I started with this, and I don't know if it's your humility or your candor or whatever it is. Wasn't Harry Truman was the first president who said, let's do national health?
Actually, it was Theodore Roosevelt.
Is it really? It was Roosevelt?
It's been going on for 100 years.
So 100 years after this, what's it? I mean, you were an intimate part of this, even if you want to give people other. What's that feel like? I mean, despite the criticisms, despite the rocky rollouts, well, not so much with RomneyCare until we had to adapt to the federal thing, but then the federal. What's it feel like to have been a critical part of, I guess, social policy history in this country? Is a pretty big deal, even for those who don't like it. They'd acknowledge it, too. What's it feel like?
I mean, a couple of years ago, my kid said to me, how does it feel to have already done the greatest thing you'll ever do? And you know, so there's part of the reason I'm humble is because my kids keep me humble.
Yeah.
That's a great response.
In the old days, you'd say you'd be in the Encyclopedia Britannica. That's now you'll so be all over funny. The Internet, so it'll be different. But you're going to be in history. I mean, it's kind of exciting.
Look, I think it is really – it's – there are so many people who deserve so much credit for this, and some people who worked on it for so long, especially here in Massachusetts, who spent their lives. And I happened to be there when it got pushed across the finish line. But it really is just an incredibly dedicated set of folks that made
this happen. So one last question just came to me, Jonathan Gruber. How does it feel to have done the greatest thing you're ever going to do?
You know, I'm just going out and enjoying my beach volleyball now.
Excuse me.
What's up? At least he's done one great
That's
thing.
That's a very fine point.
Some of us
Thank
are
you,
still
Margaret.
Waiting. You know what I mean? Okay,
Jonathan
Gruber
is
a
so
professor
much.
Of economics at MIT. He would advise both Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney and President Obama on health care. Thank you so much for being here. Up next, the clothing retailer H&M is doing its part to drive down the high cost of getting married. Would you avoid years of credit card debt if it meant buying a $99 wedding gown? We're going to debate the cost of weddings up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is a conversational, fast-paced look at the news of the day. It's a morning news program that is live and in the moment, able to turn on a dime when news develops. We call what we do journalism in the raw. It's live, unedited conversations with newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news. There's kind of more at stake. So listen to The Takeaway. It's The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Museum of Science, where you can step inside the Hall of Human Life and exhibit you and discover how everyday human behavior affects our brains, our bodies, and the world around us. Details at mos.org/exhibityou. And Gentle Giant Moving Company, serving New England since 1980, now offering moving and storage services coast to coast with offices in major cities across the country. More info at gentlegiant.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Eaton. Clothing retailer H&M just unveiled its $99 wedding gown. Let me repeat that, $99. It's Grecian-style long white. Looks quite pretty to me online. But the average cost of a wedding gown beyond H&M is somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,000. The average cost of a wedding, I almost can't read these words, $38,000 in and around Boston, $28,000 nationally. So to seriously offset the cost of tying the knot, would you buy the $99 dress? But that really isn't what we want to talk about, even though we can. Would you do your part to chip away at really is what has become a marital industrial complex? Bridesmaids and bridegrooms, how great would it be if you could buy your wedding wear for a fraction of what folks typically pay? We did research. By the way, our number is 877-301-8970. This is so out of control.
Totally.
$38,000, according to Boston Magazine, in Greater Boston. $38,000 for a wedding.
We're all talking
it is
about
staggering.
Saving for college. And then you think, oh, boy, my kids are almost out of college. And then you think, man, you've got two daughters.
I do.
Two of my three kids are daughters. I think, oh, if they don't elope, what the heck am I going to do then? You know, you have to encourage them to elope. I think it's the only way to go.
Have you ever heard the word signaling used in the way it's used in a story we read this morning? In this story on H&M and the $99 dress, they say one of the reasons why people buy, I think the average cost of a wedding gown, it said in Boston Magazine in Greater Boston, is $1,300.
Mm-hmm.
One is because it's signaling. It basically it's some sign of social status, even if you don't have that social status. And secondly, it allegedly shows your commitment to your spouse to be. The implication being, if you're not spending $38,000 and $2,000 on a wedding dress, then you don't really love the guy or woman or whomever you're about to meet. This is, we talk about how college costs, as you said a minute ago, are the biggest crisis facing America since the mortgage crisis. This is a close second.
Or have sons. That's the only answer.
One more number before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970. When you read this number, tell me you were not shocked. We talked to one of our colleagues this morning who was talking about a wedding he had to go to, which is literally going to put him in debt for the next 20 years of his life. It's a relative. He shall remain unnamed. But let me just say, 43% of people tell pollsters they say no to wedding invitations because they can't afford to go to the wedding. With the clothes you have to buy,
right.
Sometimes the trip you have to take,
the destination,
the presents you have to give.
The destination wedding has become a big thing. If you have kids in your 20s and 30s, forget if they even have gotten married yet or are planning on getting married, they're going broke going to the weddings of all their friends because not to mention using up all the vacation time because they have to fly to Arizona or fly to California or fly to Hawaii or something for this 3-day extravaganza with dresses, with drinks, with different outfits every day, going on midnight cruises and all this kind of stuff.
You know what the word one of our colleagues used, and I don't want to implicate anybody because mm-hmm. someone may recognize him or her saying it, that it's cruel. When you invite somebody to a wedding where you know that they have to spend a couple $1,000s on transportation, plus the hotel room, plus if they're part of the bridal party, whatever it's called, they got to buy the right dress or right tux or something, and the gift has got to be of a certain level in light of how much money they spent, you're basically saying to someone, I am forcing you to spend, I don't care what it is, $1,000, $3,000, $5,000 that you either may not have, or even if you have, you may choose not to spend. It is so presumptuous. It is so good for H&M. And by the way, if you go online, it looks fine to me. You love your...
I thought it was pretty.
It's pretty
very
enough.
Simple.
It was
you know what
it
I love, too, when you get these, and I cannot be the only one who's gotten these invitations to wedding showers or baby showers where you get the invitation. And, of course, people are online. They're registered, so you can go online and see what they're registered for. And sometimes they're...
I love it, and I hate it, both.
Well, it makes it easier, but sometimes they're really expecting you to spend a lot on these wedding gifts. But the thing is, they'll also ask you to donate to some charity. So you're donating to the charity and buying them a gift. And if you're, again, if you're 25 or 28, when a lot of your friends are getting married, okay, you want to spend like $40 or $50 maybe for the gift. Then you have to donate. What do you give, $10 to charity? You can't give $10. Then you have to give $20. So you're spending like $60 on the shower
gift.
$60
is like pocket change compared to the
cost. But I'm saying you can't afford it. And so everybody implicated, the bridesmaids, the groomsmen, just the friends from college are all going broke.
Before we start, do you not think it is, when you read the $38,000 is the average cost of a wedding in Boston, is that not obscene?
Well, this friend of mine who's thankfully his son is getting married.
What's his name?
He was telling me about how the bride's father said he'd been saving he'd given every one of his three daughters, and obviously the guy's done very well, uh-huh. $25,000 toward their wedding. Yeah. And their wedding, which is going to take place in Boston, not that big, not that extravagant, $44,000.
877-301-8970. Don't be scared off if you disagree with us. If you think this is the way you show your affection to the person and the other family you're about to join, to your friends, whatever, that's fine. It's just not... It's just, Marissa, you're in Alston. You are first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call, Marissa.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. I listen to you every day. I love your show.
Well, thank you
very much.
You're welcome. So I'm 22. I grew up in the wedding industry in the Hudson Valley in New York. My mom was a caterer. Mm-hmm. And then when I turned 16, my first job was at a banquet hall. And for a typical 5-hour cocktail hour, 3 options for dinner, chicken, beef, or fish, and then dessert, not including DJ, photographer, clothing, anything else, it was upwards of $120 a person for a Saturday night. So let's say that you want to have 100 people there, yeah, which isn't that big for a wedding anymore, in my opinion, based on what I've seen. That is an extravagant amount of money to spend, I think. And I live with my boyfriend. We've been together for a while. And anytime we talk about taking that next step between our student loans and our rent and our family situations, it's just absolutely not feasible.
Marissa, and Marjorie and I will marry you in our studio for $50. How's that?
Thank you. Yeah, we met in first grade, so we're really excited to get married someday. But that day is not going to be anytime soon based on what we've seen and what the cost is. And even for something just not that extravagant, it's out of control.
And what do you think, in light of the fact that your family was in the business, what was the motivation for people often to spend far more than they could really afford? Is it because this, you know the old tired line, it's my only daughter, it's my last daughter, yeah, it's my whatever. What was the motivation for them to spend so much money?
You know, I think it can be a beautiful occasion to bring families together, sure, for this once-in-a-lifetime celebration. And I do hope that that sentimental value is a part of it.
Sure.
But I also think it could be a chance to show off. I'm not really sure because I don't come from that. But I honestly think that money would be much better spent putting a down payment on a house.
Amen. That is perfect. Marissa, we hope that's what happens to you. Thanks so much for the call.
Of course, you can't be guaranteed it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Keith just emailed about someone who spent $25,000 on the wedding, $11,000 on the gown, and they were divorced within 2 years.
So that would be pretty depressing. On a gown.
But you know something? I think this happens often where, and this is, I hate to blame the bride, but I think it's usually the bride that gets swept up. You get swept up in all these wedding preparations, and you're planning everything, the bridesmaids' dresses and the flowers and the food and all that, and you kind of lose sight of the fact it's the wedding, and you're going to be with this guy for the rest of your life. And by the time you get to the wedding, you almost,
let me ask you something.
Not interested anymore.
Let me. If you were, despite what we're both saying, let's assume you're invited to a friend's wedding, mm-hmm, their kid's getting married, and instead of spending the average Boston cost of $38,000, they ran out of bar, and they essentially have bar food, beer and wine, it costs them only $10,000, which is still a huge amount of money, instead of $38,000. Isn't there a small piece of you that's going to say,
Well, I don't know. And my daughter went to a wedding, one of her best friends from college, that six kids bought this farm together, and they had the wedding on the farm and on the backyard, and they brought all the food. And she was an Indian from India, and they did this thing where they painted all the bridesmaids, that ritual thing the day before. And they did it themselves. What cost them a lot was the music. I guess they had a band or a DJ, or I'm not sure what they had a lot.
You know what
liquor. The liquor cost a lot.
The other thing we didn't look into before the show is the tradition of the family of the woman in a heterosexual marriage. Is that dissipating?
No, Jim, you're on the hook.
No, I'm serious.
You're on the hook for two daughters.
I mean, talk about an ant. I knew there is a self serving. Talk about an antiquated notion.
That's right.
Hannah in Maine, you're next on Boston Public Radio. How you doing, Hannah?
Good. Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I got married 2 years ago. I worked in the industry for 2 years after college.
Yep.
And it was insane the amount of money that people spent. So when my boyfriend, my husband now, we got engaged, my dad is a missionary, so he doesn't have a ton of money. And his parents, are not terribly wealthy. So we wanted to really make sure that it was affordable. And I think the thing is that we did our wedding for under $7,000. We did it on a farm that my husband works at. I had a vintage wedding that was $260. I let my bridesmaid pick out all their own vintage bridesmaid gowns.
Good for you.
My little sister catered the wedding. We did all the decorations ourselves. My brother did the music. And it was truly like everybody that went to it said it was the most beautiful thing they'd been to because it was so personal.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, Hannah, beyond the fact that you did it, $7,000 is not nothing, but it surely is a lot less than 20 or 30 or whatever. But I'm so glad you said what you said. Doesn't it make it all the better when everybody's doing their own thing? Musicians who are friends of your play music. As you say, bridesmaids pick out the dresses that's perfect, isn't it?
It was amazing. It was a perfect day, and we all got up early the day of the wedding, all my 9 bridesmaids and I, and all the groomsmen came together, and we set up the entire wedding and got ready and got married, and it was beautiful. It was perfect.
It sounds perfect. Hannah, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Isn't that the way it should be? You call them whatever. If certain friends cook, let them do a little cooking. I'm not talking about going overboard here, but there's so many ways not only can reduce the cost to something that is manageable, but also make it, as she said, much more personal. I mean, I love what they did there. Let's go to Shelley in a car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Shelley.
Hi there.
Hi.
Program all the time, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
we did a had to do a kosher wedding, and that was there were a lot of surprises to me. One of them being what kosher alcohol was accepted, and because the venue didn't have kosher alcohol, we couldn't use their bar, even though it was an open bar wedding, and so we had to bring in our own alcohol. They charged us more to a corkage fee, I believe is what it was called.
Yeah.
For the wine than we had paid per bottle of wine.
Oh, no. That's awful.
Like, yeah, there were a lot of things in a wedding that has to be kosher that add to the cost. But my daughter was very understanding, and she split the cost between the groom's parents, us, and they paid for a chunk of this wedding.
That's what it should be. There's no reason. How did the guy's parents feel about that? Were they okay with it?
He's an only child. They would have probably paid for the whole wedding.
Yeah.
The kosher part was their idea. It had to be, or a lot of their family wouldn't have come. So, yes, this was very amenable. They're great people.
So, Shelley, and before you go away, for those of us who are only experienced with kosher wine is drinking Mogan David for $1.99 or whatever, is good kosher wine good? I've never had it.
Yes, good kosher wine is the same as any other wine.
Really?
It's just pressed differently. And you're asking someone who doesn't know much about drinking or wine. But, yeah, the wine was very nice.
Great.
It was just a shock at a corkage fee.
Corkage fee. I love the expression. Shelley, thanks for the call.
Well, there's also the open bar versus closed bar kind of thing, too.
Can I tell you something? I've never been to a wedding. I've never been to a wedding until a few years ago where you actually pay for drinks.
Well, I think a lot of people do it because they can't afford the liquor bills.
But isn't there a solution to that, too? You know, even though I'm arguing for lower cost, you know,
shut down the bar?
The solution is beer and wine. Just don't have, you know, we know what you drink, but I mean, you're a top of the line drinker. So for one night, you got to have a glass, you have to have a, what's the matter with that?
I think you know, beer and wine for most people.
What, Johnny Walker Black
I don't think you have to have Johnny Walker Black, but I think a lot of people would prefer to have, you know, a cocktail.
But do you feel I'm arguing against myself, but isn't it a little weird to go to a wedding and buy drinks for $17 or whatever it is?
They're not $17. But I went to this very swank wedding this summer that a friend of mine down the Cape, and I thought they must have spent $50,000 on the liquor alone. I mean, people were just bellying up to the bar every 2 seconds. Listen to this email from Maureen in Brookline.
What'd she say?
Quote, an invitation to a wedding involves more trouble than a summons to police court. This is attributed to William Feather, a 20th century American writer. It is really true. And you know what? Hannah said that she let the bridesmaids get her own dresses. That's another thing.
What is up? Why does everyone have to match? It looks ridiculous.
And also, they always say, you can wear this dress again. Well, you can never wear the dress again. You know, I remember going to weddings a million years ago when people were all pregnant, so we had to wear the Empire's waist thing we were going to wear again. But you almost never do. So you'd spend $250 on a dress you're never going to wear again anywhere.
Well, that gets back to the presumptuous thing. Even if you're a close friend of the woman who is getting married, how offensive is it to say to someone, you've got to go spend $250 not only for a dress you'll never wear again, for a dress that you're probably not going to be that crazy about so that we all match. I mean, it's just the whole industry. Someone's got to take a lead on this. And maybe it's Barack Obama. I don't know. And just someone's got to take
the bully pulpit. He's not getting much else done this term. Why not?
Exactly.
Why not go for the? I mean, he's got two daughters. He's the perfect person to advocate. Okay. Jeff in Plymouth. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
You should share the love, Jim, and just tell your daughters you're going to buy them year-old Subarus. That'll run you about $38,000.
That would actually make me happier. I'm not sure it would make them happier, but Jeff, I wrote it down. Thanks for the advice. What else?
I got married about 20 years ago, and I think where the disconnect had come from. We didn't scrimp. We were economical. My wife made her own dress. But the cash gifts, which weren't exorbitant, basically covered out-of-pocket expenses to the wedding. And I think what might have happened is that the overall cost of the wedding have gotten incredibly exorbitant compared to what people could afford to pay as gifts when they go for the wedding. And with that, thank you, and great show as always.
Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
We weren't going to read this, but in light of the fact that Jeff brought this up, I am going to read it. There is Amanda, one of our colleagues, found this. This was on the Huffington Post. A couple sent, I may get the story, I may play with the facts a little, so correct me when you think I'm going over the line here. A couple makes a $100 wedding gift to this particular couple. The recipients, the bride, writes on Facebook, in terms of the amount we got from you both, it was very unexpected. As a result, we were very much short on paying off the reception because just for the cocktail, I assume this is legit, and reception alone, the plate per person is $200, parentheses, as per a normal wedding range with open bar, it's about. And Mike and I have both already paid for everything else, including decor, photography, attire, and didn't expect we had to cover that huge amount for the reception as well. And they go on to excoriate the couple that gave the $100, saying, your finances appear to be quite fine. And now, I'm assuming, even if this isn't real, I'm assuming some people have this feeling. But that's another thing. The expectation. That's why I don't, while those, what is that, those registries you mentioned before, while on one level it is great because you get gift ideas, the prices of some of the things, unless you buy the crappiest thing on the list, are just incredibly cruel, as our colleague said. It's just cruel.
I know. $200 a plate. Maybe I should knock off the real liquor and just go with the beer and wine.
It's just, let's take one or two more quick ones. Let's go to Jay and Andover.
Jay, I'm sorry.
Hi, Jay.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Excellent. Great. Thanks.
So what I've been doing is ever since my both daughters were born, the first month they were born, I put $50 a month in a separate account for each of them.
Pretty good. Like a Christmas club. Yeah, good.
And then the other recommendation is anytime I go to a wedding of a close friend of ours, I always give a bottle of scotch or a type of liquor that the father of the bride likes.
That's
what
good.
They have to go through.
That is good. A great one, Jay. Thanks for the tips. Let's
you
take
know,
one more.
That old movie, it's about 15 or 20 years. Steve Martin, Father of the Bride,
oh,
the first one. The second one's not so good, but the first one is hysterical.
You know what I watched this weekend, one of the funniest movies? You ever seen The Jerk?
Yes.
It's 1979, so it's 35 years old. I'll tell you, it is literally like fall down funny. Chris in Weymouth.
Hi, Chris.
You're going to finish things off. Hi, Chris.
Hi, guys. Great
Hi.
Show.
Thanks.
Two scenarios.
Yeah.
Two weddings over the summer, two nieces. First one was $43,000 at some park up in Manor Park up in Peabody. $43,000.
Oh, my gosh.
The dress cost $4,000. Second, Megan. I rented my VFW hall. The whole family got involved. We had a caterer. The wedding cost $5,200. The dress cost $1,600. Moral of the story, the rest of the money went for our house for a down payment.
Well, that's what the earlier caller said. That is which would a young couple like more? Is a down payment on a house or a wedding as beautiful as it is? I know you videotape everything these days, but it's a one-day kind of deal. Chris, it's a great story. I said one more. We're going to take one more only because this guy has an interesting notion about where this all started. Quickly, if you can, Patrick in Attleboro, you're next. Hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think that it came, I got married probably 4 or 5 years ago, and it seemed like there was a huge rush of television programs about weddings and brides. And it seemed like, my wife would sit there and watch television, and you'd see some girl, being flown to her wedding on Pegasus or something. and we sit and go, oh, no, that's how it is. It's like, okay, well, we can't afford Pegasus, so what we'll do is we can get horses. It's like, oh, no. Like, most people aren't getting any type of animal to carry them into their wedding. And I think it just got blown out of proportion so much that the norm became it became heightened. I was like, oh, no, that's what people are doing. Like, oh, my gosh, that's what they're doing around the world. No, people aren't doing that. They're having regular weddings. And, we ended up having to pay a portion of ours. And my parents, both families were involved. And my parents were like, we'll pay a little bit. And we don't have to be split equal. But my wife and I had to put a percentage in. And as the dollar value rose for my parents, ours did too.
Hey,
and also we became very cost conscious.
Yeah,
well, Patrick, you got it right.
He's
I think your history lesson may be accurate.
And Brides Magazine, which has been around for ages, but these TV shows about getting married, it's absolutely true.
By the way, Facebook, Alexander wrote in and said, weddings should all be held at fast food joints the way the kids' birthday parties or pizza parties are held.
But we had a lot of great emails. I couldn't read them all. People that managed to do it on a shoestring, as they say. So read those, Jim, when the time comes.
I'll be reading them right after the show.
Up next, Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane joins us for her take on the SAT overhaul. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Edgar B. Herwick III here from the WGBH Curiosity Desk.
Now, we've all heard that sea levels are rising, but scientists say that here in Boston, they're rising 4 times faster than the global average. So what does that mean for us? Join me and some of the region's top scientists right here at WGBH on March 28th for a live panel discussion about climate change here in New England, part of WGBH's Smart Conversations series. Limited tickets are available at wgbh.org/events.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Celebrity Series of Boston, presenting the Vijay Iyer Trio with special guest Robert Pinsky in Poem Jazz, a unique duet performance of poetry and jazz, Friday, March 14th at Sanders Theater. More at celebrityseries.org. And Doc Martin. Martin Clune stars as a brilliant physician whose blundering social skills and grumpy demeanor make for awkward interactions in a small town. Don't miss Doc Martin, Wednesday at 9 on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Tuesday for Open Mic, is Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey there, Nancy.
Hey, great to be here.
Hi, Nancy. So tell people that don't know, what changes have been proposed for the SATs, and is it a good idea, bad idea? What do you think?
So let me first start off with giving credit to Todd Balf, B-A-L-F, the New York Times reporter who wrote this very long, very interesting, careful article about the story behind the overhaul of the SAT. The chief protagonist is a guy named David Coleman, who's been head of the College Board, the institution that administers the SAT, for several years, and decided when he took the position up, that he was in the kind of bullseye of a lot of different groups. Teachers were angry, parents were hangry. Parents both at both ends and in the middle of the income spectrum were angry. Students were anxious. Colleges weren't happy. No one was happy, and he went around and did a lot of kind of hunting and gathering and reconnaissance to try and figure out what was going on, how to overhaul it. So here, are the major changes. First, the SAT will go from being 2,400 possible points, right, 800 math, 800 verbal, 800 essay, to being 1,600 again with an optional essay. And but more important than the essay kind of peeling off and becoming, living in optional land, is what's going to happen to the content and the thrust of the questioning in both math and verbal. So Coleman thought it was very, very important, again, after lots of listening and research and thinking and whatnot, and talking to admissions deans, right, who, according to this article, people like William Fitzsimmons, who's been at Harvard for a long, long time, are encouraging of the changes, are encouraged by the changes they see. Coleman is going to make the content, the thrust of the questions, much more what he calls evidence-based. So instead of, hirsute is to bald, right, as birdhouse is to robin, right, or all those analogies, instead of that being a good example of testing your vocabulary, I remember the flashcards, right, in the big thick book of vocabulary words many, many years ago, instead of that being the kind of the kind of thing that students will come to expect, it'll be more like analyze this paragraph in the Gettysburg Address. Literally, they're going to use founding documents and then describe what Lincoln means by government of the people. So, and some of that will be multiple choice, but it will be much more based on our critical faculties, our high school students' critical faculties to take what they're learning in the classroom. Teachers were angry because they felt the SAT was based on all these clever kind of questions that didn't test what they were learning, and yet they were being held
accountable for, right?
They were being held for accountable for in terms of school performance, and so it'll be much more based on like, well, I read A Tale of Two Cities, and here's what I think the word synthesis means when Dr. Manet talks about synthesis. So it's going to be much more about critical thinking and finding solutions within both the math part, which is going to be divided into three sections. I'll come back to that. Finding solutions based on what you're presented with, and very importantly, what you already know, because the one of the incentives of the reformed SAT is to make students very conscious that what they're doing in high school is actually going to help them on the SAT, as opposed to kind of bolting this on as a separate, very high stakes activity that is filled with anxiety for them. So it's going to be based on solving problems, both in the verbal part and in the math part, which will have some similar things. Can you figure out how to deal with equations, right? Because equations are very much part of, you know, logical thinking in life as well as in school. Can you figure out how to use percentages and fractions and ratios, which we all have to do every day, even if we have a computer calculator and we do online banking, right? And can you figure out in what they call the passbook to higher math, can you figure out how to deal with advanced equations? And I'm not sure how that fits into the grand scheme yet. But again, the main kind of volte-face, as they say in Italy, the main turning, right, of the ship of the SAT is to sync it up much more clearly and closely and obviously with what the students are learning in school, and to make it much more synced up with how predictable it will be as a guide to performance in college, you know, and P.S., give people, a chance to use what they've been learning all these years, which is how do you formulate an idea about something and then present the evidence. You have to do this every single day. You do it in studio all the time. Your guests do it. And then present the evidence to support what your creativity and intellect and emotional awareness has told you is true about a certain issue or person or problem.
Now, first of all, we should assure people that volte-face will not be on the exam. Yeah. Now, Emmett Price was here yesterday from Northeastern. He teaches there, professor there. And I said to him something that I want to temper a little bit. I said, I'm upset, actually, that the essay is disappearing. And frankly, if I had to dump something from the SAT, I'd dump the other two if I had to dump something rather than the essay. Because how you communicate, either orally or in writing, is critical. But then I remembered something that I had totally forgotten. One of the best shows Marjorie and I ever did was X number of years ago. And the reason I was reminded is because the opening paragraph of the story in the New York Times Magazine, that MIT had done a study with hard data that shows that the content of what you say, the accuracy of what you say, the strength of your reasoning in the essay had nothing to do with the score you got. The only thing that tracked the score was the length of your essay. Now, by the way, he had all this hard data. This guy's name is Les Perlman, director of writing at MIT. The best part of the story is, can I say his name, do you think?
Sure.
Matty Siegel, who's probably the most famous talk show host in town, calls Marjorie about a year later and says, and I hope I get this right, says, I was listening to your show that day. My kid was about to take the SAT. She hadn't done so well in the writing the first time. I told her, I just heard on the air that there's a story from MIT that Jim and Marjorie are talking about. Write forever. Doesn't matter how wrong you are. She got the highest score she had gotten on anything. So while that is a real problem, would you not agree in a perfect world, I know it's not, how someone communicates their thinking in writing is more important than how they respond to a multiple choice question, even if it's more, as you say, evidence-based
much more important. So I teach this big course I've mentioned on the air a few times called The History of Leadership. It has a huge writing component to it, which is very unusual in business schools. It's an expository, critical writing component. Mm-hmm. My students write 5 short papers based on thesis statement, right? Advancement of thesis with supporting, cohesive, related evidence and a conclusion demonstrating the significance of what they thought about, say, Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, for example, which is mm-hmm. what I taught today. And when I first pushed this forward to the dean of Harvard Business School, he was excited because he thinks that this is a critical skill for our MBAs. And yet, Jim, to your point, it's not really being taught so well or so diligently at all levels of the educational value chain before our students get to even postgraduate work.
One of my big problems is that they have stopped in even good school systems teaching kids how to write well.
How to write. And it's so critical. So I say to my business school students who look at me like I have two heads when I say the bulk of your grade is on these papers and then your big integrated mm-hmm. essay at the end that's going to be, 3,000 to 5,000 words. They look at me like I have two heads until you start pointing out things like, what's a great cover letter for a job? Well, it's a thesis statement about why you are a particularly good fit for that position and then the evidence of that. What's a great pitch for a new piece of business? It's a thesis statement about where the opportunity is and why you're the person who can deliver on that opportunity. What's a great business plan? What's a great sermon? Right? What's a great RFP? You name it, you have to use in verbal communication and in writing this faculty of critical thinking based on evidence that you have marshaled, selected, and then integrated. This is essential to effectively doing, creating a civil rights movement, if you think about Martin Luther King, right? Or Dietrich Bonhoeffer writing about anti-Semitism in 1933, or to founding a company like Amazon.
So if this is the case and you agree with me, let me interrupt you. Just say,
please.
So this respected, and I've heard his name, never met him, the Fitzsimmons, is that his name?
William Fitzsimmons.
The sort of the dean of deans of admission, yep. One of the highest profile of all of them. If people like him, who obviously know what he's doing, are celebrating the making the essay voluntary, and we seem to agree that that skill is a critical one, we're either missing something or they're – and by the way, most people who have been critical of the College Board are celebrating the changes, not being critical of them.
But I think primarily because of what you just said, or the story you just told and the evidence that MIT has, it's not – and it's even more egregious in some ways than you let on, Jim, in that, right, there's demonstrated evidence that people who actually wrote long essays with literally blatant factual inaccuracies still scored high. So I think probably – I don't know. I have no inside information – that over the next 4 years, this is the new SAT is scheduled to come into being in 2016. So it's another year or two of the old format. I think we'll see once we see if the College Board can figure out logistically how to grade them, how to mark them and score them. Scoring them
that's
in
a big deal.
Big deal. How to score them. How to make the science of scoring and therefore the message you send to students. One of Coleman's rationales is we're sending all the wrong messages to students. It's about memorization. It's about game playing. It's about spending, if you can afford it, lots and lots of money for the Kaplan course.
$4.5 billion for what this writer calls the worried wealthy. I love that expression.
Exactly, the worried wealthy. He's trying to send a signal down through the educational populace, if you will, the students and teachers, et cetera, parents. This is not a good use of your time. Do your homework. Do your schoolwork. That's going to really help you for the SAT. And P.S., one of the interesting kickers in this article, I had no idea of this, is that they wanted to figure out the College Board how to provide preparatory services that would reach all kinds of people of different zip codes and income classes. So guess what? They go see Mr. Khan at the Khan Academy.
Which is great.
And they've started a series of conversations and, kind of petri dish templates, prototypes of how the Khan Academy might, with College Board, in conversation with the College Board, administer online free open access to again, effective test preparation. The Khan Academy is talking about doing this sooner for the current SAT as well to get at this inequality piece.
Well,
it's terrible.
Interim.
It's so expensive. These courses are absolutely crazy. You spoke about Emmett Price and Irene Monroe being here yesterday. We do a segment called All Revved Up, There Are Two Reverends. And Irene Monroe talked about the whole cultural problem here that, she grew up in Brooklyn, tough childhood. One of the vocabulary questions on her SATs, the word define regatta. And she said, I had no idea what were the multiple choices.
That's
a
great
card game. Is it a both thing? So I would assume they're going to address some of that as well to make it less culturally biased.
I get this is the sense that this is a bottom-up renovation, right?
Yeah.
That we're starting with in the I-beams, right, or the concrete slab of the foundation in terms of emphasizing a totally different emphasis on content. I mean, I remember. I taught the Kaplan course, by the way, the prep course
you
for the SAT.
Not. Is that true?
I put myself through graduate school doing all kinds of odd jobs. I was a male woman. I was I taught the Kaplan course in Central Square many Saturdays. And, it really is a test in how to prepare for a very particular kind of game or system. I'm not, we understand why colleges have used this. We understand.
Even though they're using it less.
Even though they're using it less.
Which is one of the reasons why they're making changes.
You bet. And one of the reasons they're making changes is because college admissions officers are not sure, and professors and faculty are not sure this is a good predictor, right? The ACT is interestingly, which is much more content-based in the way we're talking about content, much
and
more knowledge-based.
Competing.
And it's competing
heavily.
Much more intently. It's getting used more often, I think, because of some of these issues than the SAT. So they've got competition, as one of the commentators in the Washington Post said, it's Pepsi and Coke here. This is Coke's new salvo. But one of the reasons this is really important and the reason they're doing it is because they're trying to get away from the idea that this is this very high stakes, very anxiety-provoking enterprise. It has nothing to do with the rest of your life except that it determines or can have a huge role in determining the big gateway into upward mobility and economic possibility, which is college education. It's not the only road. It's not the only door, but it's an important door.
You spoke about the equality issue a minute ago, as did Marjorie. And one of the great ideas, which is only an interim fix, for lack of a better expression. I mean, on the Khan Academy thing you talked about is heartening. Mitch Kapoor, who is the founder of Lotus Sulphur, who's a local guy. I think he used to live in Brookline or whatever. I don't know if he does there anymore. This piece in the New York Times mentions that he co-wrote an op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle. I love this. Yeah. Suggesting that colleges require mandatory disclosure by students and parents of, quote, each and every form of purchased help as a way to level the playing field. Meaning, while you're working on leveling the playing field, both in terms of, as you say, the cultural bias, Marjorie, the questions themselves, and about the access to help and broadening that as well. Obviously, if you have Marjorie Egan gets 550 and Nancy Kane gets 600, you would say if all other things are equal, they take Nancy Kane if you have similar outside, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if you find out Nancy Kane spent $4,000 at the Kaplan course that another Nancy Kane taught, the likelihood is it puts Marjorie Egan back in play. And so I think that disclosure thing is great.
What else is surprising? That the schools themselves, the public schools or private schools for that matter, maybe private schools do, I don't know, but the public schools don't offer free help. I mean, when I was in school, we got drilled every day for the SATs by our English teacher. I wish I could have got drilled more by the math
teacher.
Yeah, but
these things, I didn't take, I don't know if I took courses or just used books for the SATs. When I took to get into law school, I took the LSAT. Mm-hmm. The courses there, Marjorie, are full-time at like 10 hours a day, 5 days a week for weeks.
Yeah, I mean, SAT's not, though.
Well, but it's let me tell you, when we were in school, it was not nearly as cutthroat as it is now.
No.
You've written articles about it. We've read articles. It is so cutthroat, the competition, particularly in the parental level, forget the kid level, that $4.5 billion
is the prep
is spent
industry.
On this is just unbelievable.
I know Kaplan is going to be very upset if all of a sudden Khan Academy is offering his courses for free.
They are, and so is the Princeton Review. It's interesting if you look at some of the data, though, and this is – Coleman knows this better than anybody, right, that about how different test scores, right, just correlate directly with income, correlate directly with parental degree, right, educational achievement. They correlate with – you know, in some sense, privileged achieving households with means being able to nurture their children and move them, you know, straight on up in a way that is simply not so possible for now, increasingly the middle class and the working class. Interestingly, one of the things that Coleman and his team are trying to do at the College Board, they're modeling some of what they're doing off of what Daniel Portersfield has done at Franklin and Marshall, the president of that college in Pennsylvania, is to literally reach out into high schools, reach out into, in general, less privileged or middle class kids who have scored very, very well in either high school or in the SAT and encourage them to apply with lots of financial aid to selective colleges. So trying to pull people in. Franklin Marshall has pioneered. They have broken all kinds of paths doing this. And Portersfield will say, we're a more diverse, we're a more connected, we're a better educational community.
Well, so is your place as a result of the reviled Lawrence Summers, who started the income blind. I mean, he did, despite the other criticism.
Oh, yeah.
Saying if your family income was under, I think at the beginning, $40,000 and now it's. But, you know, one of the things that we started on yesterday, if you were to say to me, and I have no expertise in this area, is it the writing thing? Is it math and verb? What's the single most important thing they should do that they don't almost ever anymore is interviews. If you said to me, I'm the dean of admissions of a college, what's the one thing I want to do? Forget, you don't need an SAT.
Schools can't afford it.
Don't even, you know what a lot of schools are doing? And one of my kids had this experience because I said
interviews.
You need alumni interviews.
Yeah, those are great.
You train alumni. It's not as good as having people who are experts in the field. Yep. But don't you get to know a person and their brains and their skills 1,000 times better when you sit across from them for 30 minutes than reading how they did on a multiple choice exam?
Yeah, a lot of small schools still do the interviews, but a lot of big schools do not.
I don't know. I should know this, but I don't know if Harvard – I don't think they require it at the college level. I know for many years that I've been there. I'm a Harvard alum at the graduate level, not at the college level. My graduate degrees are from Harvard. They encouraged interviews by alumni. So a good friend of mine, Tess O'Toole, is a PhD and a BA from Harvard College. She used to interview people all the time that were applying to Harvard College. That was clearly part of their folder. Whether that was required or not, I simply don't know. And I know that certainly lots of graduate schools, business schools, and others use it as a tool to get a sense of the person. You know, I was just coincidentally last night eating popcorn at 11 o'clock and reading the Stanford magazine. My AB is from Stanford. And Fred Hargadon.
And so is Marjorie Egan.
And Fred Hargadon, Marjorie knows that name. Fred Hargadon, who was the dean of admissions, who admitted Marjorie and me.
many years ago and then was later dean of Princeton's admissions, died recently. And he was known for remembering every single freshman's file. I remember he knew my file.
I love that.
He knew it. He knew what my SAT score was. He knew I'd play tennis, and he loved my essay about wanting to be a pro tennis player. And he talked about just that. You're taking the whole person. Right, you're taking the whole person.
Well, I love it. And I wish, and you're right, the expense is the issue, so be creative about it and fix it.
Yeah, and it is just so, it's so unfair, as you said. If you're a middle-class kid, you can't afford all these extra tests, or you're really struggling, it's just so unfair. But anyway.
When I was applying, I was hoping they wouldn't do interviews, by the way, and luckily they didn't, so it all worked out pretty well.
Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, great to see you, as always. And thanks to you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we've got Boston Globe editor, Brian McGrory. He's going to be here. And we're going to have our concert roundtable, which is fantastic. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and John Parker. And I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browley.
And we're so glad you're here, Jim.
See you
later. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.